the higher efficiency is not going to give you the higher profitability in certain cases. And so you need to attach yourself with other numbers, you know, to kind of make sure you are on the right track. But what we, I think the good part was that, or the interesting part, is that with that added Autolyze East, then was easy to see. So we saw effect on performance, that these cows now, they can eat more and they can produce milk in a different way, in a composition where they are allowed now to produce more fat.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible. Mycotoxins can threaten feed and cattle performance. DSM Firmenich offers a portfolio of solutions to help mitigate the impact of mycotoxins in your feed.
With early detection in health, reproduction, and feeding, SmaxTech future-proofs your dairy operation. Excellent, a novel product for the management of hypocalcemia. It's uncomplicated excellence. Volac, unlocking ruminant potential through nutritional solutions for a sustainable future. Priority IAC, the only company bringing the fields of microbiology and nutrition together. Adiseo USA, producers of SmartAmine M and MilkPay.com.
Good day and welcome to the Dairy Podcast Show. Mark Thomas here from Dairy Health. And this afternoon, it's a pleasure to have with us Dr. Phil Cardoso from the University of Illinois. Dr. Cardoso is a professor in the Dairy Science Department. Welcome, Phil. How are you today?
Very good. How about you? Are you in Mexico, United States?
I am in Mexico. I am in Torreon, where I live.
Is it ever cold in Torreon, or is always warm?
I guess cold is relative. It's right now we have about the perfect weather in Torreon for cows. Low 20 Celsius during the day, 10 to 12 in the morning Celsius. You know, December, January, February, we can be zero or 32 Fahrenheit in the morning. Rarely snow, but occasionally we'll get freezing.
That's good. Yeah.
On the flip side, as you probably know, the high desert will have very high temperatures in the summer months. We're about 1,000 meters, a little over 3,000 feet. So sun exposure and then, you know, temperatures into the 40s, very dry. So that's our nemesis, if you will, the heat stress.
Yeah. And then it's interesting, like you're talking about cold and, you know, it's kind of relative because I'm originally from South Brazil. So it doesn't snow, but it gets pretty cold. But I start noticing that, you know, old pictures, you'd see people, they never left their jackets. You know, they would keep their jackets inside the house and during dinner and everything because, you know, the heating system or the whole isolation, you know, have brick walls.
Yes.
So it's something that is very different than the U.S. where you would see pictures of everybody with their T-shirts and even shorts during the winter because, you know, the heating system was so good. So, you know, hot water is not a given. And here you get, you know, hot water all the time whenever you want. So you're right. Cold is a little bit relative sometimes.
Certainly an adaptation. Yesterday morning, there were many people with jackets on and it was actually super comfortable, probably low 60s or so. And but I guess like the cattle, we adapt to our environment.
Mm-hmm.
So, Phil, given that, just mentioned growing up in Brazil, tell us a little bit about your background and how you got to University of Illinois.
Yeah, sure. So I was born in Brazil, in South Brazil. So it would be the southernmost state, Rio Grande do Sul. So it borders Argentina, Uruguay. So a lot of the gaucho kind of Spanish tradition there. It gets cold, and then I was interested in animals, and then you go to vet school. That's what it is. You know, most like the European system, you go from high school to your degree. You don't have the animal sciences in between. So you go from high school straight to vet school. Throughout the vet school, discover my passion for cows, and not just only the animals, but the whole system and how people would depend on that activity to survive. that was different than horses, pets, and sometimes beef, where it was more like a hobby or something on the side. Dairy, I met some Italians and, you know, German immigrants that really survive on that. So went through vet school, and since done with vet school, started working on my working in northwest part of the state where there was a lot of dairy cattle. So built up my clinic, started working there for 5 years with mostly repro and a little bit of nutrition. And then throughout that, I was having a lot of issues with displacement of abomasum, DAs, and people wouldn't know what was that. And I graduated in 2001. But before that, I came to the U.S. in the 2000s, and, you know, vets were doing that all the time. You know, that was like 40 minutes, they were done from beginning to end in a DA, you know. That was very common. And people back in Brazil, they, what the hell is this? You know, they would feed different things to the cow. They thought it was like stomach impaction. They would do different things, and the cow was just keep dying. So then I did my master's on that. So I'll get a DA cow on my client, and then I'll get a cow with the same lactation number, days in milk, and I would collect rumen fluid, blood, different things. And then out of that, then I published that work. And that got me to in this transition period kind of curiosity and said, what the hell? Why is this? Why are all those cows DAing? I had clients that every week I was cutting two or three DAs. I said, no, that's not possible. So they started listening and reading some of the papers about, hey, how nutrition can impact or alleviate that. So then I was looking for places for a PhD. And then in Illinois here with Dr. Drakely, that was a place that, oh, I know kind of, I really want to learn more about this. So came here to do my PhD. And then just in 2010, Dr. Mike Hutchins retired. And then in 2012 was when I had, they opened the position and I just joined the faculty. And then since then, that because of that more also repro background, is trying to bring some of that perspective with nutrition. So the impact of that nutrition with repro, not all the times, a lot of our trials, they only have the nutrition perspective, and that's fine. But then we bring some of the physiology, histology, you know, that sometimes it gets forgotten, to kind of explain a little bit better why we are doing so. More of a holistic type of approach whenever we can.
Excellent. That sounds like a very practical background. I think back to my early days in clinical practice and starting to do ration balancing and nutrition, and some local nutritionists saying, you know, what is a veterinarian doing concerned about nutrition? And my reply always was, well, name for me a disease of commercial or economic importance on a dairy that's not directly related to nutrition. That usually got them to pause for a moment and say, oh, okay, maybe it has some some common sense to, yeah, to look at that.
Our Yeast 40 is a natural biotechnology from ICC, designed to boost the health and productivity of animals under challenging production systems. Our Yeast 40 performance is supported by an unique processing technology that results in a pure product containing high levels of beta-glucans, MOS, and yeast metabolites. These factors, combined, promote the ruminal and intestinal modulation, helping the animals to reach their full potential.
It's also really interesting to look back. I think in general, you know, what we learned and what we do, and hopefully that segues well into the topic today of balancing starch and diets, is years ago, it wouldn't be uncommon to maybe do 5, 6 or plus DA surgeries in a day. You know, you ran out of surgery equipment and you came back the next day to do them. Now in some of our herds, we less than 1% of fresh cows. So, you know, really, the cow probably hasn't changed all that much, but how we feed cows has certainly evolved for that benefit.
Yeah, and I have I think was 2015. I gave a talk back in Brazil about displacement of Abomasum. And then I asked for a friend that I kept going back to Turlock in California at Lander Vet Clinic. So I spent some time as a student there and then kept coming back every 2-3 years just to learn. So I saw the ultrasound starting. You know, everybody was palpation. You want an ultrasound, I'm going to charge you a little bit more for the hour. And then one vet of the group would pick up on the ultrasound, not everyone. But then I asked them to go back and you tell me the number. And they was about 1,500 DAs that they were doing in 2006. And then back in 2014, that was 200. You know, so throughout the time, and I think we learned a lot about nutrition at that time that kind of prevented us from having to cut all those DAs. But at the same time, it faces, I think, a challenge for the vet clinic, right? I mean, you're not getting that income anymore. So I see where veterinarians now fulfill a pretty big role in nutrition because it's so impactful.
Yes, and if it's not directly formulating rations and you know, being a nutritionist, at least being fluid and knowledgeable of nutrient balance and proper ration formulation, and obviously all the practical aspects of feeding management. So great. Well, so as we segue into the topic today of starch and dairy cow diets, give us a little bit of an introduction. Obviously, some research that's ongoing with you and your team in this area, and some interesting findings to report back, both from the formulation side and also then from use of some additives, I believe.
The idea is that, you know, throughout that whole transition period and trying to boost as much energy as we can to the cow, the starch comes up as a, you know, one way very attractive, especially here in the U.S., to do that. However, you know, just I would say recently, NASEM. So if we go back, you know, get a step back and say, okay, and you were just talking to Bill Wise this morning, you know, the NASEM co-editor, and you ask him, hey, what's the requirement for starch? And it's none. There isn't one. We may develop a requirement for energy, but we don't define very well where is that energy coming from. And you know, already putting myself ahead of myself is that, you know, maybe that's the next step. Instead of just talking about energy, we should be talking the components that make that energy and give clearer, more of a clear recommendation. Because when you saw a prepartum diet, oh, this much energy. Yeah, but then it can come in different forms and shapes, and more starch, less fat, more fat, less starch, soluble fiber, you know. But just recently, there was that connection. So starch has no requirement. And there's this connection that is very hard for you to untie energy from fiber. So usually, if I go up on fiber, I go down on energy, and vice versa, right? So it gets a little bit of confounding. And what we were interested is, it was, okay, we deemed that whole starch idea, what's still something we would like to know more. And one thing is that looking back to the high starch, low starch trials, a lot of those, there are replacement of ingredients. So let's say, hey, the low starch, now I'm going to use soybean hulls or beet pulp, or I'll manipulate ingredients to get to that low starch, where the high starch diet would not have those ingredients. And we wanted to challenge ourselves and say, hey, I don't want to change the ingredients, and I want to make a high starch, low starch diet. So, okay. So we got to that point, manipulating corn silage and corn grain, we were able to develop this low and high starch. And then within the high starch, then that's where we wanted to understand the feed additives. And I'm not sure if that's the experience that you have where, you know, sometimes how much I'm going to use of this ingredient, of this feed additive, sometimes the companies, they don't know. And then I'm lucky if I can convince them to do a first trial on let's understand how much you need then, right? Because if we use 50 grams and 50 grams is not good, then you just wasted your time and money in trying to understand something, right?
Absolutely.
So that's where we said, okay, let's have this high starch, no autolyzed yeast, and then we're going to have 15, 30, and 45 grams. And let's see in this production performance model if this is going to be a linear relationship, or more that I add, better we get, or there is like a plateau where, hey, 45 actually starts going down for some reason. We should be at 15 or 30. And we also want to know, hey, if I don't feed yeast at all, do I get the same answer? And testing our model, this low starch versus high starch. So that was the challenge that we had with this work that we did, that we were interested in, where we end up at calling low starch at about 22-23% starch. And this high starch, we call 31% starch. So we went from 22 to roughly 32%. I'm not sure in Mexico, the farmers that you deal with, you said, oh, not too high in starch. What is your take on low and high starch?
Yes, so that's a great question. We're often managing some rations that are very low in fiber. Fortunately, we do have access to sugar sources, as you said, so that, you know, energy requirement versus starch. But certainly there are some rations that are in the low to mid 30s when we're, you know, when we're getting into these low fiber rations. And those are diets that certainly there's an adjustment period to get to those levels.
Yeah, and I would say here, especially in the Midwest, you know, 25, 26% is kind of on the lower side, and anything about 28 to 32% starch, that's what they are pushing on the high side. And I think there are other things on the diet that allow them to go there. But one of the things that we were interested in is in, first, in this high starch versus low starch, using the same ingredients, then we kind of could see this, you know, things that others have seen as well, where low starch, you get less milk. And this was, they were all kind of early to mid lactation, so about 70 days in milk where they started the trial. So you could see that they produced less milk, they ate less, maybe there's some fiber limitation there because of that high inclusion of corn silage. And interesting enough, the low starch diet, they were more feed efficient when compared to the high starch diet. So even recently at the Penn State Nutrition Conference, I kind of teased a little bit the group when we were debating. I think Alex was there. And so Trent, the PhD from Cornell, was there. That was
Trent Westall, and yep.
Yeah, Westall. And I think it was Norm St. Pierre, good friends with Bill. So then we were talking about, hey, do we want to be efficient all the time? Because I was questioning, you know, like if you are, let's say, I'm pretty sure that cars in Formula One, they are not efficient in the sense of gallons per mile. They may be efficient for another goal, that is breakage or turn, how fast they can build the turn. So when we talk about efficiency, we are always fixed on intake per milk. However, in this case, a low starch diet gives you more efficiency when compared to a high starch diet. However, the amount of milk and maybe the profitability that you get is totally different. So sometimes my point is, you know, maybe a little philosophical, is that the higher efficiency is not going to give you the higher profitability in certain cases. And so you need to attach yourself with other numbers, you know, to kind of make sure you are on the right track. But what I think the good part was that, or the interesting part, is that with that added autolyzed yeast, then was easy to see. So we saw effect on performance, that these cows now, they can eat more and they can produce milk in a different way, in a composition where they are allowed now to produce more fat. And so that's kind of okay. We've seen that Saccharomyces cerevisiae kind of doing that. But then what we did, we got those cows, they're all rumen cannulated. So we were able to do the whole nitrogen efficiency and apparent digestibility.
Okay.
And we also did little baggies with corn silage, alfalfa haylage, and soybean meal. And those little baggies, we threw in the belly of those cows eating those different concentrations. So we have how the cows are performing, and we have how the feed is being digested, and what's her digestibility. So we call it the gradability of feed ingredients that are commonly used. And we have this apparent digestibility. And what we saw is that about that 30 grams, those cows were able to degrade and digest better the fiber components. So for example, organic matter was better digested if we added that autolyzed yeast at 30 grams within that high starch environment. So that's something that if we go back and you see even the new NASM now acknowledges that, hey, your ADF, NDF, or forage digestibility impacts your intake. That's the new way of calculating dry matter intake in NASM is taking in account your feed. That's one of the equations there. So I felt that was interesting that we saw that difference in intake being higher with the yeast. And we were able to see as well that, yes, the yeast is doing some work in helping digest that fiber. So we felt that that was something very interesting.
And that was use of, can you elaborate more on the yeast or product or anything of that nature?
Oh, yes. So that was autolyzed yeast, Saccharomyces cerevisiae. And then we were top dressing the cows. And that was a Latin square design. So cows received all the treatments so we could kind of eliminate the cow effect on that. So performance-wise, okay, it seems like the corn silage, alfalfa haylage, that was being degraded in a greater extent with the inclusion of the autolyzed yeast. So organic matter increased linearly, degradability of soybean meal, for example, alfalfa hay, ADF, rate of degradation was increased. So there's this clear signal that a change in the rumen environment is happening to improve that digestibility. Like I said, the intake makes sense even now with this new equation that we understand that impacts how much the cow eats. And the other thing that we did kind of a little unique was we know that these high starch diets, they often, most likely, they're going to cause some lower rumen pH. So some acidosis may happen, especially if you don't have the fiber component in the diet. So one thing we were curious about, and we saw that in the trial, the high starch diet had lower rumen pH compared to the high starch diet, lower pH compared to low starch diet. And we were able to do rumen papilla biopsies. So at the end of the period, we would collect the papilla biopsy, the papillae from the rumen. And then we did some gene expression. And just to be like, you know, talking more easy here, out of the genes, one of the things that we notice is that linearly, as we increase the amount of yeast in the diet, then the amount of tight junction proteins, so we measure one called Claudin-1. That's a gene that codes for a protein that's going to make sure all the rumen papilla, the cells are together, you know, the connector of those two cells. So that's kind of some of the effects may be coming as well just by not allowing perhaps some of that deleterious effects of lower rumen pH and maybe even some bacteria migration from rumen to the system of the cow that may be something that it's also causing. And that could be just because it's manipulating rumen pH. But at the end, we saw that effect of a better or not so expected, you know, like we call leaky gut, probably reduce with that. And I mean, could be only the pH, but could be also some direct impact on those cells. And that's something, the exact mode of action, if you ask me, I'm not sure if I can tell you. You know, we know what's happening. We still have a follow-up work where we're doing trying to understand the changes in bacteria, and we are seeing that it changes. So some population of bacteria is changed in the rumen because we collected rumen fluid, we collected rumen contents. So we know that the type of bacteria is changing. So if you'd ask me, is this being a direct effect? Is this autolysis being used as a substrate by somebody else that now it's doing the effect? I wouldn't know how to tell you. You know, that's kind of, I think, is still to know a little bit.
Discover Schuller's flexible and reliable dairy feed ingredient solutions to help support your herd's growth and well-being. Schuller is a trusted partner in dairy feed solutions, delivering high-quality feed ingredients when and where you need them. Discover an extensive portfolio of product options to fit your unique rations and cost parameters. Learn more at schuller.com/dairy. That's schuller.com/dairy.
Based on your experience in these trials, what is the timing that it takes this rumen flora to change? I guess we from practical experience, we can say what we believe based on clinical observations, if you will. You know, how long does it take a cow to adjust to a ration, et cetera? You know, when we're faced sometimes with unexpected changes, oh, a month ago or so, you know, no soybean meal availability due to the rail car issues here in Mexico with, you know, strikes, et cetera. You know, we make changes sometimes if they're more drastic in passes, you know, not all at once. So, you know, do you have any information to say that obviously some of these changes probably maybe take a whole lactation or you know, the cow adapting to a different type ration, but any comments on that?
Yeah, so in our trial here, we allowed at least 21 days of that yeast to be consumed before we kind of change anything. There are some reports of, I would have to go back to the date of some old trials where they emptied the rumen and then they put it back in the cow and they saw that in 48 hours, everything was okay again.
Yes, yes.
And you know, so it's kind of it's amazing, but I mean, it's not something low starch environment. It's just like a change. So I think the 21 days we did carry over analysis, and we didn't see any. I think the 21 days is plenty of time for that work. I think there may be other DFMs that they may take a little bit longer, and that's maybe it's just a matter of how they are packaged, you know, see if they are ice poor, that they need to grow a little bit, and then I don't know. And I don't know also if this autolyzed yeast, if they would have a direct impact on the cows. There's some suspicious, but I'm not sure, you know, like really going to a terminal trial and having biopsies we've done from some other trials, but not this one. Where I would be very curious about, you know, Peyer's patch and how that has been impacted by other types of DFMs. Or luckily, we did a trial with a DFM that we fed from prepartum to 15 weeks postpartum, and we were able to capture differences in IgM in milk. And that was one of the things that we thought that, hey, maybe that was a bacillus at that time, that it could have some impact on this Peyer's patch that are involved in this whole immune system and, you know, providing more of or indication that that could be a way for having more Igs being formed by the cow. So there may be a direct impact of this autolyzed yeast in the lower tract, digestive tract. But I think in calves, there's something more clear. In beef cattle, I don't think in dairy cows we've been clear about that, but that may be something there.
No, I think that's what's really interesting. Likewise, we've done some trials and obviously plenty of published information on the immunological effects of some of these products and reduction in certain diseases, somatic cell count, et cetera. So, you know, the combined, if you will, rumen health, animal health aspect, and how some of these products actually work their mode of action. Yes, I think we still have lots to figure out on with some of those products.
Yeah, but I think if you think anything that can lead you to help in fiber degradability and digestion and improved VFA profile, cows being able to use more of that energetic source, you know, you can apply in farms where, hey, I didn't get the corn silage I wanted this year. Farms that maybe some pens that are a little bit overcrowded where the third last cow, it's not getting the same TMR as the first ones that are sorting a little bit. You know, there are many situations that you can see this as a tool to try to get away with maybe a little bit of a lack in management or a year that was just not good enough, you know, on forage.
Certainly, yeah, absolutely. I guess we always look at those as tools that we can use, tools in our toolbox that we don't want to call a Band-Aid, but yeah, they're available. And some maybe have use all the time, and others when you have a specific risk factor, if you will, or challenge, certainly. So, Phil, when you talk about yeast in general, obviously there's lots of products on the market, and you know, what are all created equal? You know, what are some things that you've found in your research of, I think that's always, you mentioned Mike Hutchins, and I recall, you know, many times his presentations and our publications on supplement use, right? The benefits of supplements and the economics of such. Here's the research, here's the potential return. So when you're looking at the many different products that are on the market, and when I say many, many, you know, what are some of the criteria you use to potentially select a product? Obviously, research, number one, there's published research on the product, but can you comment on some other aspects?
Yeah, I think that's the, like you mentioned, the research is the number one, you know, trying to avoid that. And I think there was a Mike's perspective, the Me Too, you know, there's a company that says, Me Too, I do the same. You know, they don't do the research and they try to claim the research done by others for them. So it's up to us to decide if that's good enough or not. But I think oftentimes the return on investment is something that you look at. If you're adding something that is not required, then we need to understand why we are adding that. Even though I know that sometimes it's not easy for us to gather all the benefits, you know, like for example, in the yeast, if I'm having some, you know, disease reduction because of it, and I'm just focusing on higher intake and milk fat that we got with the trial, then you may be missing some of those incomes. So I think that's something that it's fairly inexpensive, or the return on investment, something that can fit in the diet. Sometimes, you know, you're pushing these cows and there's not much room on that diet for you to add things. So if I ask you, hey, can you add 2% of clay? You may say, that means I have to take out 2% of something else that I'm already missing to give that cow enough energy, right? So you have to see what is that inclusion rate or how easy can we add that? Yeah, I think that's kind of the return on investment. As many more research, more you can add to that. What is the space that I have to play with? How easy it's going to be for you to add that in your system. And also try to look for maybe within that category, let's say yeast, what are the products that can add more to you? So we know that, you know, like this yeast products, they usually are coming from bakery, but they have different sources where they're coming from. And I think the companies can do, or they should be doing a good job explaining to you what's the difference. So for example, if I raise a yeast in a different environment, now I'm going to have more beta glucan. that is one of the components that may be the substrate for other bacteria to grow and digest better our fiber. So if another company has another product with less beta-glucan, what does that mean? Maybe I still get the same, we didn't talk about, but the, you know, the chelation, or sometimes they're used as adsorbent for mycotoxins or toxins in general, even and you know, endogenous some toxins that those yeast may be working on. Maybe the different layers, they may play a little bit different. So I think it's very important to know where they're coming from, how they're produced, and companies, they should be able to give you that information and justify why it's different than this other one in the market. But usually this ones I've seen, and that's the one we tested with this extra beta-glucan, it seems to be something that can add more to that rumen function.
I think your point there, you know, the return, right? There's different products, obviously different pricing of these products, and it really comes down to that, right? Of the return on the investment. You know, we're generally looking for at least a 2-to-1 return on a product, but you know, if you have to feed it through all of, for instance, close up, transition, you know, what is that price per cow, if you will? What does it cost per cow per day? Are we going to realize that in milk, reproduction health, or, you know, some other outcome?
Yeah.
So I really like that approach. And if that data is available, you can't go off the coattails of our product is the same when maybe it's not the same.
And the other thing is that sometimes, you know, most of the farms, they do a good job understanding the intake of the pens and what is that conversion rate feed to milk. But some farms, they don't. And so some farms, they will never see the impact of feed efficiency because they don't have the intake. The milk may stay the same, but now cows are converting better. They will never see it. They may see it, the amount of, you know, but of feed that they are delivering. But if they're not measuring the feed delivery, at least a little, you know, once a week or something, they are doing some refusals. We still have farmers like that, and products like this that work on efficiency, they may get just dismissed because, hey, this doesn't work. But it's just a measure of what you measure in your farm is not enough to capture that.
That's a great point. We have a trial of a yeast culture product published in JDS, but you know, in first lactation cows saw no difference in milk production, but almost a kilo less consumption with the same milk. So right there, it's a win.
Exactly.
In adult cows, it was, you know, second greater lactation was decreased dry matter intake and more milk. So a win-win. But again, we always use that as an example. If you just measured milk production and you did a on-farm evaluation, you would say this product doesn't work when it's a 3+ to 1 return. So,
yeah,
you know, be careful on both sides of the quote research or on-farm trials.
Yeah, that's why, you know, and I appreciate you doing all this. We've done one commercial farm trial in California. It's extremely challenging, you know, just to control, just you are in Mexico. So we had to hop into the feeder's wagon and the only language was Spanish. So if you don't speak Spanish, forget about trying to understand what really is happening at the farm, right?
Yes.
Yeah, so absolutely. There are some challenges where nutritionist, owner, and feeder, they're not on the same page. And you are the piece that needs to now connect all those three things, you know, refusals, you know, like simple things like we don't want cows off feed. We want cows off feed. And, you know, like the owner would flip flop depending on the price or whatever was happening to his day. You know, he would know, I don't want any feed left over. And then the nutritionist says, no, I want 3%. And there was all that. So running a trial in the middle of that is kind of extremely challenging, but necessary, I think, to understand and enrich the discussion around what really works at the farm, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. You know, small pilot trials with 25 cows can be useful, but then, you know, that doesn't necessarily explain the commercial aspect of using some of those products day to day.
Yeah, that's one thing that we do. And I think that's a very good point is that I believe in this smaller setting, university research settings, we really maximize the impact of the treatment because we know the cows are eating, We control that, it's a top dress, and we try to avoid and actually block statistically for a lot of the differences. And so when this is working, that's okay, let's go now and really figure out if this overplays a lot of the other variability or not from the other systems, right?
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
Our Yeast 40, ruminal and intestinal double modulation by ICC Animal Nutrition. Feed solutions that surpass expectations. Learn more about the benefits of working with Schooler. Visit schooler.com/feed. That's schooler.com/feed. Natural Biologics delivers cost-effective solutions to improve health and productivity, helping conquer the rumen health and immunity challenges your animals face. Your partner for extra animal performance, Bergen Schmidt Animal Nutrition.
AgriTrack, leading traction solutions for herd health. Contact us today to boost safety, comfort, and savings for your herd. Invest in the best. Who would your cows choose? Modern solutions for modern cows with AHV. Contact us to beat biofilm-related issues in your herd. Your cattle are constantly threatened by the exposure of mycotoxins in feed. Now you can know if mycotoxins are present in your feed and what you should do about it. DSM Firmenich offers a range of analytical services to assess the mycotoxin contamination and solutions to combat mycotoxins. Don't let mycotoxins contaminate your performance. Visit dsmfirmenich.com/mycotoxin-survey to learn more. That's dsm-firmenich.com/mycotoxin-survey.
No, that's a great point. We can be confident a product works, but then does it work in the environments and the rations and the climates, et cetera, that we are actually going to use it. So, you know, all very important points. So Phil, as a bit of the take home points from this is, I guess, efficiency can vary by starch levels and maybe what you think the higher the starch is maybe not the most efficient, correct?
Correct.
And then there are supplements that can certainly help, if you will, mitigate or balance the effects of higher starch rations.
Yeah, and I think that's we should, and maybe on that efficiency was a trick to say, I don't think we should be scared of being there on that 30% starch. I think physical effective fiber or other things need to be there as well. But I think, interesting enough, when we added autolyzed yeast, it's not the greater amount, the 45 grams, that gave the best result. You know, there were some linear results, but actually that 30 grams was the one that was kind of the sweet spot to be. So that's kind of interesting as well. Not always more of something is better because now it interacts with something else. And actually, we could have tested the cubic effect because we had those five treatments, but then it just got a little confusing to understand, for me at least. So we kept with the linear quadratic, but that was very clear that 30 grams of the autolyzed yeast would help you go to that higher 30% starch and maybe get some of the benefits of that extra milk yield coming
okay.
with that.
No, that makes sense, really. And again, really investigating what other effects, like you said, you might not think some of these products have a detrimental effect, but potentially do when you get to higher doses or what have you. So we always need to keep counter effects in mind, I guess. So Phil, thank you. I think a great review of some of the current research and maybe a bit of out of the box, a little bit thinking of, you know, we can manage rations with different levels of starch and until we maybe have further data for NICEM type publications, collaborations, we deal with an energy requirement, but, you know, look for the future where perhaps a starch and sugar, non-fiber carbohydrate would be a requirement or a recommendation. So Phil, sincere thanks for connecting this afternoon, spending some time with us on the Dairy Podcast Show. Some great insight. Look forward to having you back again in the future with some more updated information. So again, thank you.
Thank you very much.
So for all of our listeners, don't forget to make note of the sponsors of the Dairy Podcast Show that make this possible. Thanks again, Phil. And with that, Mark Thomas with the Dairy Podcast Show signing off. Have a great day.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with elite remote talent without a time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on your $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.